Before we start, just a warning for our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners. This episode contains voices of people who have died. It also contains graphic descriptions and audio of a death in custody, which could be distressing for some listeners. In late 2015, 26-year-old Dungati man David Dungay Jr. died in Sydney's Long Bay Jail. Last month, the inquest into his death finally wrapped up. But what is it actually like when a family member dies in jail? And how hard is it to get justice? In an attempt to answer these questions, The Guardian has been documenting the Dungay family's journey for 3 years via a podcast called Breathless. Today, we're bringing together some of the most important moments from Breathless to tell you what really happened to David Dungay Jr. I'm Laura Murphy-Oates, and this is The Full Story.
About to receive a phone call from an inmate at Long Bay Prison Hospital. Your conversation will be recorded and may be monitored. If you do not wish to receive this call, please hang up now. Go ahead, please.
Hello.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Tried ringing you. Couldn't get through. I spent nearly $20 a month for the last couple of days.
Well, this is David Dungay Jr. He's in Long Bay Jail, and he's talking to his sister, Cynthia.
How you going?
Hey, good, sis.
At the time of this phone call, David is 26 years old.
Miles Herbert is a journalist and one of the producers of Breathless.
He is a Dungati man from Kempsey.
How's the insulin going?
Yeah, it's going good, yeah. So it was a bit high today because I got a boy up and I'll eat some food.
David is an insulin-dependent diabetic, has been since he was 6 years old. So in this phone call, you can hear him talk to Cynthia about managing his blood sugar levels.
Well, I never got lollies or anything. Don't buy lollies and that.
What, do they give you lollies for you when you go low?
Nah, they give me Weet-Bix and that. Or sandwiches, extra sandwiches and that. Or not extra sandwiches, bread.
How is he doing that?
Well, he does it through, you know, how anyone would manage their blood sugar levels, by eating biscuits, eating lollies. That's what he's done ever since he was a little kid. And that continued throughout his incarceration. He would continue to self-manage his diabetes.
Yeah, lollies, yeah, jelly beans, and that. Remember when Mum used to buy it?
Yeah.
Yeah, nah, they don't give it any. They used to do it at the Bay, you know, in Area 1. Mm. They still, but they stopped it because I don't know why. Probably cost too much money for them.
Yeah, is there heaps of diabetes in there?
Yeah, there's a few, not heaps, but there's a few.
Yeah, like a few, like, yeah.
Yeah, a couple, yeah.
What, you right, buddy?
Yeah, I'm right.
Being strong, there, old?
Yeah, being strong, yeah.
Ring up tomorrow.
Yeah.
Lunchtime.
I ring tomorrow and sister, I love leaving it.
Lunchtime.
Yeah, lunchtime after lunch, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, all right then, sister, I'll ring tomorrow then. Love you, see you tomorrow.
Love
you. Take care. I'll send you a card too. I sent you a card, Christmas card, for you and the kids and Maury. Yeah, all right then, sis.
Yeah.
What happens after the phone call?
While he was out in the yard, he purchased a packet of biscuits from the buy-ups. So he returns to his cell and he's eating the packet of biscuits that he bought for himself. Corrective service officers storm the cell to try and remove the packet of biscuits. 6 minutes later, David is dead.
So you've been talking to the Dungay family for quite a while. What did they say about him? What is he like?
Do you have a favourite memory of David?
Yeah, I do, actually.
They just really loved him. He was their son and brother and uncle.
Me and him always used to tease each other and was like twins, and it was like we was twins, but it was a year apart.
David comes from a big family in Kempsey, and they were all really close. Cynthia, his younger sister, is the closest to him in age, and she actually moved to Sydney when he was transferred away from Kempsey jail.
He'd chuck a joke, or he'll just try and make you laugh, like, and then tease you, poke you, like, yeah, yeah. He was good at joking around. Yeah.
He was being a brother.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he was. He was a great brother. He was kind, happy, go lucky. He was the kindest person I ever met.
Yeah, they all doubted my little brother. He can't play footy.
Ernie is David's older brother.
Dave was playing and he was playing. Little brother to start players off.
So Ernie and David played football together. And when you talked to Ernie, David was just this great football player. In fact,
little brother, I should have seen the tackle he done on him. Fuck, man, the crowd just, that was just ghost, mate. Fuck, it went quiet. Just, you could just hear everyone just, oh, what? Classic tackle, like, shit you don't get trained, you know, it's just in our blood.
If you talk to anyone in Kempsey, the first thing they're going to talk to you about is how good David was at football. It's the first thing that comes out of people's mouths.
You know, it made me real proud to play my little brother. He was deadly, Jane. I'm telling you, he had heart, fucking heart of gold.
I'm Latona Dungay. I'm David Dungay Jr.'s mother in Kempsey area we live. We're Dungaddy tribal people. And he was a Dungaddy warrior.
Latona is David's mother. In every conversation you have with her, you can just tell how much she really loves David and how much she misses her son.
He did know when he was low, and he knew when he was high. And he knew at the time of his death.
David's diabetes was ever present in their life. It was an everyday thing, you know, especially being diagnosed at such a young age. The whole family had to kind of come together. Everything from what Latona cooked for dinner to Cynthia giving David some extra lollies when they go to the shops. It was something that was a part of their everyday lives.
And the only thing that I could think of was that he was going low. He was going low to eat food to keep alive. Without going into coma. So I think about those things because I was his nurse and diabetes educator, and I'm thinking of quite a lot of what they've missed out on, what they've done for my baby boy. And that's why I still say today that biscuit, they killed my son by taking his biscuit away.
Do you think that David's death should have been preventable?
Yes, it should have been. He cried out that many times. It could have been preventable. He could have been alive today.
I just can only imagine that was going through his mind at the time and that day when I was doing that to my little brother.
The most traumatic thing is seeing the footages of what happened.
Paul is David's nephew.
Like, that's something that's going to be playing in my mind forever. I think of that about at least once a day.
And Paul and the rest of the Dungays are really eager for everyone to see the CCTV footage that they have seen.
Okay, so we know that David died after guards stormed his cell because of a biscuit. According to Paul, what does this vision show?
Do that now.
They storm the room, shields first, and tackle him to the ground.
One, two, three, go, go, go.
My uncle's saying, I can't breathe.
You want to get...
I can't breathe, please!
Can't breathe, I can't breathe.
You're talking, you can breathe.
They're saying, oh, you're talking, so you can breathe. So they call in doctors and nurses to give him a sedative, which is what they gave him, is 10 milligrams of midazolam.
Just comply with the directions, Dungay. You're going to get a medal now.
Just keep him there,
resisting, be still.
Shortly after giving it to him, they say, Dungay, we're going to leave you now.
Dungay, just comply with all the directions. We'll be out of the cell. Have a night to yourself.
He doesn't respond.
Okay. Dungay.
Year one guard go, oh, fuck, he's gone. Oh, fuck, he's gone. So they start CPR. Not really straight away. They got him onto the floor and they put this tube in his mouth to suck all the blood and that he swallowed that he was choking on. So there's a safety cap on it. You can see it clearly in the footage. There's a safety cap. And you just take the safety cap off first to suck it. they've shoved this safety cap straight down my uncle's throat, you know, probably pushing all the biscuits he ate and all of that stuff and pressuring it in and blocking it in to choke him. So they've basically shoved this thing, probably about a 50-cent piece thickness, down his throat and then pulled it out. They're trying to suck everything out. Nothing's coming out because the safety cap's on. So then they pull it out and it falls out of his mouth. And the doctor goes, "Where'd that come from? Where'd that come from?" And the screw goes, "It's a safety cap. You didn't take the safety cap off."
What is it like in that room after you've seen the footage?
It's just silence. Like, everyone in the room is just, yeah, it's just silent. No one's talking. We're just all looking at each other. And it's just, yeah, it's basically silent. And, like, everyone's ready to cry. When I watched it at the end of it, they say to him, "Breathe, Dungay. Breathe, Dungay." Instead of letting him breathe at the start, you know?
I had to give Mum the bad news. It was pretty fucking hot. What was that?
My son knocked on the door, then I walked out, and then
Mummy, when I told her, she didn't want to believe it.
And I just walked away and walked in the bathroom, locked the door. So I'm a funny person. I like to cry on my own. I just screamed out to sweet Jesus, "Why did you take my son?"
Oh, fuck, no, man. Yeah. I started to grab Mum. Yeah, and just hold her up. And just let her know that I'm there. But yeah, no one else. That's the hardest thing I ever done in my life. I was telling my mum, little brother died.
"Why has he gone? Sweet Jesus. Only you know. Why did they take my baby? Is this really happening? Is this real?" To watch my son pass away in front of my eyes, it's devastating.
Is the death penalty in Australia? Because what I've seen happen to my brother, that's just like getting the injection, death ray. And the thing is, now they're getting rude shock because, see, my mother, she's the most strongest black Aboriginal lady, ma. I've seen my mother go through a lot. She's a dad and mum in one. Me, Junior, Cynthia, and my older sister, Chrissy.
What did the family do after his death? What action have they taken?
Let's go. Bring the banner, come on.
Well, after David's death, they immediately started fighting for justice. So a year after David died, they marched in Kempsey. And shortly after that, they started marching in Sydney. And Latona...
They took him away. And never come back. It's the age of 19.
Just started speaking out.
My son was overpowered and restrained.
She wanted to tell everyone and anyone about David.
Why is this happening? Why is this happening in Australia today? How many of them need to die?
Justice today for David Dungay.
They'd sort of become the face or one of the faces of this movement for justice for Indigenous people in our incarceration system. Is that right?
Yeah, so after David dies, Latona, I think, is really eager to add her voice to the many voices already out there who are fighting on behalf of a larger Black Lives Matter movement and a larger movement to seek justice for those who have died in custody.
We need to get angry. We need to have a voice and heard. The Aboriginal of Australia needs to take a stand because there's too many mothers like me who have lost their sons. This is our land.
So at the heart of this is seeking some answers around David's death. What happens?
Almost 2.5 years after David died, the inquest into his death finally begins.
How are the family feeling going into this?
The inquest was tough for everybody, but the family was there every single day. And there were some really tough moments in the opening days of that inquest as the CCTV footage was played again and again and again, each time a new witness came and sat in the courtroom. As that footage was played, some family members would sit steadfast and others would kind of filter out of the courtroom, the young ones especially.
Okay, so we know from the CCTV that David's cell was raided because of these biscuits. What did we learn about the reasons for that raid in the inquest?
Well, what came out during the inquest was that David's cell should never have been stormed and David should never have been removed from the cell he was in, cell 71.
How did this actually happen that the order was given to raid David's cell?
So there's some concern throughout the morning about David's blood sugar. Nurse Zhu, who was responsible for monitoring David's blood sugar, called the doctor on duty and communicated that to him. And the doctor told Nurse Zhu that David's blood sugar has been an ongoing concern for the last month and that they would reassess tomorrow morning. But there was absolutely no need to intervene at this point in time. Mm. After that phone call, Nurse Zhu communicated to corrective service officers that the biscuits David was eating might be of some concern to his health. The corrective service officer misunderstood Nurse Zhu and thought it was a medical emergency and that they did need to intervene. They thought they needed to put David in another cell, one with a camera in it, and remove David's biscuits. Throughout the inquest, the officers testified that the nurses had requested David to be moved cells and the biscuits be removed. But also during the inquest, the nurses testified they made no formal request for David to be cell moved. So this was all really just a miscommunication. And nursing staff and corrective service officers arrived at the decision to enter David's cell without ever consulting a doctor. In fact, the coroner found there was no medical reason for him to be moved cells and that despite his blood sugar levels being high, he wasn't displaying any symptoms and eating the biscuits would not have been an issue.
Okay, so that's one of the big issues that's come out of the inquest. What are some others?
So after we heard from the officers that stormed David's cell, we also heard from them about the use of restraint. And basically, the coroner just said that the use of restraint was unnecessary and administered poorly. The coroner found that the five guards who did restrain David face down on a mattress in cell 77 had no training into the risks of holding someone like that, the prone position, which we know from this case and from other cases around the world can be fatal. The coroner also found, in terms of the medical restraint of David, that the second call for chemical restraint was completely unnecessary and would have required a doctor's order, which was never given.
What do you mean by chemical restraint?
Often in corrective service environments, they use high-powered sedatives on people who appear agitated, like midazolam, which is an antipsychotic drug. In David's case, they called for an initial injection of midazolam, and after that injection, they ordered another injection of haloperidol, but David died before that injection was able to be given.
And what did he say about those injections, the coroner?
The coroner found that the first injection of midazolam was clinically sound, but the second injection was not clinically sound, because there wasn't enough time for the original sedative, midazolam, to have taken effect. And the fact that this second sedative was to be used meant David was held down in the prone position for even longer than he should have been, meaning he would have been unable to breathe for even longer than was necessary.
Okay, so this kind of raises some issues with the medical care that David was given at this time. Was that a big feature of the inquest?
Yeah, it was. It was a big feature of the inquest and was a big feature of the final coroner's report. Dr. Trevor Ma, who is responsible for the resuscitation of David, the coroner found that his resuscitation attempts were just completely inadequate. So he failed to provide adequate CPR for up to 8 minutes. And also, you've heard from Paul how the team who was administering CPR, led by Dr. Trevor Ma, forgot to take the safety cap off of the resuscitation device.
CPR is a pretty standard procedure, even for civilians. I mean, how did this happen? Do we know much about that?
Well, we know that Dr. Trevor Ma had never administered CPR to a person before. This was the first time he had ever attempted to resuscitate someone.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so those are some of the major findings. Were there also any recommendations for disciplinary action?
So the strongest recommendation from the coroner was in relation to the medical care given to David by Nurse Zhu. And Nurse Zhu has been recommended to the Nursing and Midwifery Board of Australia for consideration of his professional conduct. And during the incident that led to David's death, Nurse Zhu left David's cell and didn't perform any medical observation on David, despite David resisting restraint and continuing to tell officers he could not breathe. So given that, the coroner found, on the basis that Nurse Zhu heard David scream for help, that was clinical reason enough to remain in the cell and continue to monitor David.
It sounds like some of this was avoidable, that David was crying out for help during this time. Were there any other options that were considered other than what played out?
There weren't. In fact, the coroner found that no other alternatives were considered at any point, despite there being no clinical or medical reason for David to be moved cells. And I think one of the big failings the coroner found is that despite the existence and presence of an Aboriginal welfare officer, a person David had interacted with before, they were not called to try and de-escalate the situation. The coroner found there were no attempts to de-escalate David through an Aboriginal liaison officer or welfare officer or by anyone in Long Bay.
And that's part of the procedures and policies of the jail, I assume.
That wasn't policy at the time, but since in his report, the coroner recommended that New South Wales Corrective Services make it policy that if an Indigenous inmate is agitated, that the presence of an Aboriginal welfare officer is available at that time.
What did the family think of this, about the outcome?
Well, other than Nurse Zhu, no one else involved was recommended for disciplinary action.
Why?
Basically, the coroner found that corrective service officers and the other medical staff, in a word, acted in good faith and did the best that they could. In the coroner's report, he says that this was not their failure, but it was a systemic failure of training.
How did the family react when that was read out?
The family were upset. From the beginning, they wanted individuals charged. They didn't want the coroner to just recommend improvements in training while the guards involved in the incident remain working in corrective services. For them, that just doesn't look like justice. When the coroner finished his findings, Paul and Ernie immediately stood up and started doing what they've done for the last 4 years, which is continuing to advocate for David.
If corrective officers did not move David Dungay Jr. from cell 71 to 77, this would have been preventable. I wouldn't be standing here right now talking to you guys. I'll be home with my uncle getting ready for Christmas. needs to come a time and a place where this does really happen. Criminal charges need to be laid against prison officers and guards, whether it's assaulting an inmate or killing an inmate whilst in their custody.
Then the Commissioner of Corrective Services, New South Wales, walked out of the courtroom.
Who's Jesus, I will?
My uncle's in the grave. What? Now they just walk off like nothing 4 years later down the track, right? And they walk away.
And Paul and Ernie started to follow him.
Train the officers, mate! Hey, Commissioner! Train them properly! Stop killing our people on this land! Stop killing our people!
See this face?
How can you fucking sleep?
See this face?
Got no fucking conscience.
See this face?
They followed him to his car, and I think more than anything, just wanted him to really remember who David was.
See this face? I hope you see this face when you close your eyes.
Paul kept pointing at his shirt, which had a photo of David on it.
I see my uncle's face. I see the videos painted of my uncle being killed. When you close your eyes, I hope you remember this face. Because me and my family do remember the people that you're protecting killing him.
How did the commissioner react?
He didn't. He just walked away. He didn't say anything. He didn't react. He just got in his car and drove away.
They sit in here and lie for the past 4 years about my uncle and saying that he did this and he did that and it could have been preventable. Don't blame organisations for its failures. Blame the individuals involved. How about that? How about that? Just remember what land you're walking on. Respect it.
Okay, it sounds like there's incredibly emotional and chaotic scenes going on. In all of this, where is Latona and what does she have to say?
Well, Latona took her time coming out from the courtroom. She spent about 30 minutes upstairs drafting her statement. And when she came out of the courtroom, she was really calm and she was really collected. And she addressed the media like she has done so many times before.
I am disgusted and deeply hurt. He wasn't a danger to himself. The only dangers was from correctional service officers. Ask yourselves this. If an Aboriginal man held down a white man until he was dead, where do you think those Aboriginal men would be?
And she echoed the statements she's made in the past.
I am the mother, his mother, and I want justice where the life of Aboriginal men is worth something.
That she is just not going to stop fighting until she lives in a country where her son's life matters and where Black lives matter.
Right, because this is one inquest. This is one death. There's been multiple other deaths this year in custody. And I went back and looked on the website, on the Guardian website, with the Deaths Inside database to try and figure out how many people have died since David. And there's been at least 40 Indigenous deaths in custody from what I can find looking at those figures. To me, that is astounding. To many people, that would be astounding. I'm wondering if this inquest gives us any solid lessons about how we can stop this cycle.
Well, I don't think any inquest can really tell us that. I think what we do know is that Indigenous people are the most incarcerated people on Earth. And when talking to the family after the findings came down, something that they said just really stuck with me. The family didn't understand why their loved one had to die for the system to change. Mm. They didn't understand why David had to die for the coroner to recommend New South Wales Corrective Services to improve their standards of practice. They didn't understand why Indigenous people in general had to die in custody for prisons to improve their duty of care.
Right, because we see this happen time and time again. There's an inquest. Everyone's dragged before the court, and then a new training manual comes out at the end. I mean, surely that's such a small amount of change each time for, you know, at the heart of it, what's instigated that is a death. I imagine that's incredibly frustrating.
I think the family feel as if it's just not enough. And when you heard them outside the courtroom, I think the sentiment from the family and the sentiment from everyone outside was these small changes, these small recommendations that come from these coronial inquiries just aren't going to be enough to stop black deaths in custody.
We need things to change in this country. Aboriginals, Australians are dying in all our jails far too often. We Aboriginal people, my people, are almost 30% of jail population. It's a disgrace. I'm going to fight until I live in the country where black lives matter.
Yeah.
We know that these processes are very dehumanizing, but at the center of this are a people and a family that's lost someone. What do they say about how they want to remember David, how they want David to be remembered going forward?
I think the family want David to be remembered the way they remembered David. A loved one, a brother, a son, an uncle. They want people to remember the person who exists outside of the 102 pages of the coroner's report. And the person you hear talking to Cynthia and Latona, laughing and joking and just being a part of the Dungay family. The person you hear in one of his final phone calls between him and his mother, Latona.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Write me Christmas.
Yeah, I sent it yesterday. Christmas card. Yesterday, Monday, Sunday. So you might get it this week.
Oh, the Christmas card.
Yeah, I sent you a Christmas card during on Cynthia. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, I already sent it. Yeah, I remember I was saying that to you. That's why you was asking me, eh? Because I was saying that to you.
Yeah.
I read, the only one I'd probably cry what I written in there. But when you read it, just be strong and keep a smile on your face. You know what I'm saying? That's for the card for the years I didn't send the card. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It hurt me, you know what I'm saying, Mum? Yeah. Every time I send one or think about it, it's not there. Don't worry about it, Mum. I'm strong. You be strong now, Mum, okay? When you read a letter, put a smile on your face when you read it, okay? And tell Cynthia too when you talk to her. So
yeah, I do that every morning with the mirror.
All right, then, Mum. I love maybe then. Be strong.
Let them crack you, babe.
Nah. Nah.
Look at that mirror, babe.
Yeah. Okay, then, Mum. Bye then. See you. Love you.
Love you.
Be strong. Keep you up. Take care now.
Yeah. See you, babe.
Thank you so much to the Dungay family for continuing to share their story. Thanks also to journalist Taylor Fuller, who first got in touch with the Dungay family and kicked off this story, and to 2SER for partnering with The Guardian to make Breathless. Many Guardian staff and reporters contributed to telling this story, foremost Lorena Allam, plus Helen Davidson and Carly Earle. This episode was produced by Miles Herbert and Joe Koning, and our executive producer is Miles Martignoni. If you want to hear more episodes like this, just search for Full Story on whatever app you get your podcasts on. We also want to hear what you think about it so far. So if you are on an app that has ratings and reviews, let us know. Okay, catch you Wednesday.